Last time round, we concluded the discussion about Amira La'akum as a way to mitigate Malacha on Shabbos. We said that for all these mitigations, when we say you are supposed to do something on Shabbos, that means the mitigation is not required. However, where you have the option of mitigating, where it's not going to diminish the quality of the healing and so on, then since we say that Shabbos is dechuya rather than hutra, right? That was something that we discussed earlier on. We said that fundamentally Shabbos is pushed off, but it's still there. So you try to minimize the violation of Shabbos. Therefore, yes, you should try telling a non-Jew, and there are different ways to do that are better, and ways that are worse as well. We also said that there are times when Amira La'akum is permitted, in which case, again, this is not a requirement, but other than those, then you should try to mitigate it. Right? This all rings a bell, right? Remember, we talked about Amira La'akum. Good. Okay, so the second mitigation is Shinui, and that's what we started talking about last time. If you look on your sheet at the first source, it was talking about Hotza'a, transporting things on Shabbos. And what we said there was, your chayiv, you'd be liable if you transport things in your right hand, if you transport things in your left hand, because kahas, when they carry things in the midbar, they carry things in their right hand or their left hand, it doesn't make a difference. On the other hand, if you carry it with your foot, if you carry it in your mouth, that's an unusual way to carry something, and that's what we call a shinui. Right? This all rings a bell? We're good? Okay. We also talked about the line in the Shulchan Aruch, number 2, carrying things stitched into your clothing, also an unusual way to transport things, as opposed to transporting it in your pocket, right? That's normal. That's the way people always carry things. So putting it in a pocket doesn't help you. The second example that we gave was the writing example. And then from a conversation that I had with somebody at the end of class, I want to make sure to clarify this. If you take a look at source number 3, the Mishnah says, Hakosev shtei osios, if you write 2 letters on Shabbos, that's the minimum in order to be liable biblically for writing on Shabbos. So you're chayav, bein bimino, bein bismola. You're liable whether you write with your right hand or your left hand. The Mishnah sounds like that means that a righty who writes with their left hand is going to be chayav, is going to be liable, even though righties normally do not write with their left hand. It sounds like a lefty who writes with their right hand is going to be chayav as well. So the Gemara is perplexed. It asks, second line in number 3, Bishlama ayamin lechayev, I understand being liable for writing with your right hand, mishum de derech ksiva bekach, because that's the way righties normally write. Ela asmol amai. But why should a righty be liable for writing with their left hand? That's an unusual way to write. Ha'ein derech ksiva bekach, that's not the normal way for writing. So now this is the part that I wanted to make sure to clarify. Rabbi Yirmiyah be'iter yad shanu. Rabbi Yirmiyah said we're talking about an iter yad. Iter yad means, in this context, somebody who is a lefty. And what it's saying is, the righty is chayav, is liable for writing with the right hand. The lefty is liable for writing with the left hand.
So it shouldn't say
or. It shouldn't say.
Well,
that was the language of the Mishnah, which is why the Gemara asked the question.
So the
but
the
Mishnah's language is unclear.
Okay.
That's correct. The Mishnah's language is unclear. Really, what would have been more clear is if it said, Hakosev shtei osios, hayimini, so to speak, biyamino, hasmoli, or ha'iter yad bismolo. We don't usually have a term for righty. Iter yad doesn't actually mean lefty. What does the term iter yad mean? Sorry? Nope. It means somebody with a sealed hand. What it means is somebody who can't use their right hand. The assumption was that if someone's a lefty, it's because there's something wrong with their right hand. That's the. If you go back to the story of Ehud ben Gera in Shoftim, right? He was a lefty.
His right side.
Correct. So that's really where the term comes from. It means somebody who can't use the regular hand. But there was no word for a righty because. No offense to the lefties who I've learned are on this side of the room, but the assumption was righty is normal, and lefty is because you can't use the right. That was the that and that
right,
that's something that
average.
Above average, right? You can say that if you like. That's fine. Until modern times, lefties were trained in school to use their right hand.
Some people just don't want to.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Okay. So all the lefties who are being stifled can continue to be resentful. But the bottom line is, if you're a lefty and you need to write on Shabbos, you use your right hand. If you're a righty, you need to write on Shabbos, you use your left hand. Clear? Yeah.
Okay.
Ambidextrous. Then you don't have a shinoi option. That's not a good thing.
Really?
Well, you could try writing with your toes. That's basically a shinoi.
Like, what if you take something like in between your finger? Like,
I feel like doctors do write with their toes sometimes if you try to read the prescriptions. What?
What if you take something like in between your finger? Like, if your phone is back on your bed before Shabbos, and, like,
right.
You go like in between your finger, like not your hand, but like.
Right. So we're going to talk about how to invent a shinoi. That's where we're going. So it's a good question, just I'm not quite ready for it yet. First, we need to ask a basic question. Why is shinoi better? It's still rabbinically prohibited. Let's be clear. It's just biblically permitted. It's a way to step down from the regular malacha. But why? We're saying that it's rabbinically prohibited, but if I have to do malacha on Shabbos, that's the way to do it, because it's no longer a deoraisa. It's a step down from deoraisa. Yeah, Ricky.
I feel like if you're usually, like you use your right hand, using your left hand, you'll look weird, whatever you're doing. So, like, people looking, like, onlookers won't think that. They won't be like, oh, he's going on Shabbos. They'll just think that, like, oh, maybe.
So that's an interesting idea. You're suggesting that, I think at this point I'm done with the attendance list, right? If someone's not here, they're not here.
Like there's no Mar Zion aspect to it. So if someone's an onlooker, maybe they just think that the person's like...
So, right. So what you're saying could theoretically work for a case where the writing is justified, or the malacha, any malacha is justified. But we're also talking about people who are doing it who are not justified.
But even doing, like, anything with, like, the opposite hand...
Yeah.
It's going to look funny.
It's allowed to look funny. Why would that be allowed on Shabbos? I mean, I'm allowed to do things that are funny looking? Generally speaking, that's not true.
If people are on looking, they won't think, like, oh, this is allowed on Shabbos.
Right. I hear you, but I don't think it's going to work, because again, we're talking about people, not necessarily people who are doing it to save a life on Shabbos. We're talking about people who decide, I want to write something down. You know, I remember something on Shabbos. I'd like to write it down. Oh, I'll write it in a funny looking way, and therefore I'm okay. It doesn't. That's hard for me to sustain. Abby.
Is it because it's not like the original decree doesn't apply to that way of doing it?
But it's not a decree, right? It's a deoraisa, yeah. Writing on Shabbos. So why wouldn't it apply?
Somebody who is mildly ill, and that's what the gzera applies to. Like, say maybe in this case the gzera doesn't apply to these, like, weirder way of being.
Right, but again, that's a gzera, that's a rabbinic decree. Here we're dealing with deoraisa. So where do we have any indication that this shouldn't apply, right? Let's take it out of the realm of Shabbos. Let's say somebody said they're going to eat a cheeseburger, but it's going to be okay, or at least midoraisa okay, because they're going to eat it with a shinoi. I don't know exactly what that shinoi is going to be. I don't know if there's a shinoi in eating. But they find something, some way to do it in an unusual way. Well, we now say, well, that's only a derabanan. Or, you know, you have somebody who is going to, you know, let's take a benaram lachavero, right? So somebody's going to steal from somebody else, but they're going to steal with their left hand. So is that now only a derabanan? I don't know. I mean, what is this about? So there are multiple schools of thought for why shinui works. I'm bringing what I think is the dominant explanation, which is that, and I think I mentioned it even in the beginning of the year, there is a principle called meleches machsheves. We use that term?
Mm-hmm.
Meleches machsheves means... Malacha that, well, it means in practice, malacha that matches what was done in the Mishkan. Remember that we learn the malachos that you're not allowed to do on Shabbos from the actions necessary to create and maintain the Mishkan that the Jews traveled with in the Midbar to Eretz Yisrael and then had for centuries in Eretz Yisrael. But there were particular activities that were involved with the Mishkan, and they were done with a particular purpose in a particular way. And that's called Meleches Machsheves. It is the term itself comes from the Chumash when talking about the malachas involved in creating the Mishkan. But it is planned. It has a particular goal. It has a particular method. And in the event that you do it in some other way, then you're down to a derabanan. Example of that, if you do the malacha in a destructive way, as opposed to a constructive way, you do the malacha in a destructive way. So, let's say you have a piece of clothing and it's stitched together, and you tear the two pieces that are stitched together, you tear them apart. So, in the event that you tear apart the stitches in a way that is going to enable you to stitch them together better, right, in the future, you're tearing it apart in order to restitch it, that's a malacha de oraisa. It's called korea amanas litfor, tearing in order to stitch. Whereas, if it's just, I hate this thing, and I'm tearing it apart, then that's not a de oraisa. It's a derabanan, don't do it, but it's not a de oraisa. Clear? That's the distinction. Has to be done in a particular way, has to be done with a constructive purpose. Now, it's a little tricky because sometimes the constructive purpose comes from a destructive act, like the tearing of stitches, or like erasing, right? Erasing, just for the sake of getting rid of something, is a derabanan. Erasing so that you can write something else on that surface is the deoraisa. But it's a destructive act. It's still erasing, yes, but it's a constructive in a constructive context. Right? You can give other examples of it, but I hope that this is, you know, that this is relatively clear. Yeah.
No. Is that the only qualification for
Malachas Machsheves?
Yeah.
Oh no, there's more. This is what we're focusing on now. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. So things like Davarshenu Miskaven, where you do it unintentionally, would also come under this heading. So this applies in that Gemara that we read in source number one, which is, you know, why it's still here on the sheet, because we did it last week, but I included it because you remember they said the reason why you're chayav if you transport something in your right or left hand is because when they transported things in the Midbar, carrying the Mishkan from point A to point B, they carried in their right or their left. The implication is if they had only carried with their right hand in the Midbar, then carrying with your left hand would not be Meleches Machsheves. Right? Because it's not the way they did it. It will be a shinui. It will be an unusual way of doing the malacha. So that's why shinui is different. We learned when we did Amira La'akum, we learned why Amira La'akum is different. Right? You didn't do the malacha yourself, and we talked about them, why is it prohibited, and is the non-Jew your shaliach, and all the different explanations that we gave. Now, for shinui, the reason why shinui is taken down from the level of de'oraisa is because it's not the way it was done in the Midbar. So, what qualifies as a shinui? Right? Go back to the question, can we devise a shinui? So, there are two valid kinds of shinui, as explained in a classic piece by Rabbi Avram Bornstein, who is in source number 4, on the sheet. Rav Avram Bornstein is well known for two things that he wrote. One being the Eglei Tal. Eglei Tal is sometimes pronounced Eglei Tal, sometimes Eglei Tal. I did Eglei Tal on the sheet. It is on the 39 Malachos of Shabbos. And then although it doesn't go through all 39, but that's, don't worry about that right now. But that's the Eglei Tal. And then the other thing that he wrote, which we're also going to quote, is the Avnei Nezer, which is, bless you, a set of tshuvos, a set of responsa, which we're going to quote in number 5. So he came up with a formulation for how to understand shinui, and it starts with a basic question. Until the discussion about Meleches Machsheves, my assumption would have been that the reason why shinui is different in halacha is because it's different in practice. I didn't do things the normal way, therefore it's like I didn't do the action. But let's take that out of the realm of Shabbos. Let's take it to the realm of writing a Sefer Torah. Let's say the Sofer is a righty and decides to write the Sefer Torah with his left hand. Is the Torah kosher or not kosher?
He managed to get all the letters
right. He got it all the letters right, but he did it with his left hand. Is that a kosher Sefer Torah? Yes? You all say yes, but I don't understand. I thought writing with your left hand isn't really writing when it comes to Shabbos. Why is it really writing when it comes to the Sefer Torah?
But he's not doing it on Shabbos.
Correct. But if writing on Shabbos doesn't qualify as writing if it's with your left hand, then why does writing any day count as writing if it's with your left hand? Why should I distinguish? Yeah.
Because the way it was done in the Midbar on Shabbos. Right?
So, because we're dealing with a Shabbos-specific concept, is what you're saying. It's about this Melechas Machsheves.
Yeah.
It's not about whether it's called writing in any other area of Halacha. So that's where we need to go with this, is that distinction between Shabbos and everything else. The Avnei Nezer asks the question not about Sefer Torah, but about a get. In the event that someone writes a get using their left hand, and they are a righty, we know that it is a valid get. So that's where he starts with his question. Take a look at source number 4. He quotes you the commentators to the Shulchan Aruch and Eben Ezer, the section of the Shulchan Aruch that deals with, among other things, marriage and divorce. So he says, Be'Eben Ezer Simen Kufchav Gimel Kaswa Achalkas Mechokek Va'Beis Shmua Va'Pri Chadash. He says, in Eben Ezer, section 123, the following three commentators, Chalkas Mechokek, Beis Shmuel, and Pri Chadash, all wrote, Ditam demachsherinan get shenichta bismolo, that the reason why a get is kasher, even if it's written with the sofer's left hand, is mishum didavka b'shabbos. Dichsib b'melechas machsheves, alkein kol shekasav kel achar yadao, b'smolo lav melechas machsheves, is because it's only regarding Shabbos where we have this concept of melechas machsheves that you say, well, if you use your left hand, that's not called writing. You write with the back of your hand, that's not called writing. Avo mikomakom ksav mikri le'inyin get, but it is called writing as far as a get is concerned. V'yesh la'ayin. And then he says, well, this requires some examination. Darei matzinu b'kamen b'komos af b'lav mili d'shabbos d'choldech shalo k'dako lav klumhu. He says, you know, that's not so clear cut, because there are areas in halacha for which we say that doing something in an unusual way really isn't considered a violation. That's actually true. There are areas outside of the laws of Shabbos where a shinui matters. Doing something in an unusual way will actually matter. So he says, I need to understand where shinui is effective and where shinui is not effective. And he says there are two different kinds of shinui. That's where he's going with this. I'll give you an example of a shinui, because we're going to see it shortly in this piece, but I'll say it to you now. I'm not allowed to plant during Shemitah, right, in Eretz Yisrael. During Shemitah, you're not allowed to plant in Eretz Yisrael. Everyone knows that. Okay? Good. What if I plant in a pot? I'm not planting in the ground. I'm planting in a flower pot. Is that called planting during Shemitah? Yeah.
No.
No, it's not called planting. Except when it is. There are two different kinds of pots. There's a pot that has a hole in the bottom, right, like for drainage. And then there are solid bottom pots where if you're going to water it, you have to make sure to dump out the water, because otherwise your plant will die, right? Two different kinds of pots. A pot that has a hole in the bottom is considered to be connected to the ground. Whatever's inside of it is really connected to the ground below it. Whole discussion about, well, what if it's on the fifth floor of an apartment building? Not getting into that discussion right now. But a pot with a hole in it is considered connected to the ground. If I plant in that during Shemitah, I have planted, and then I am liable. But if the pot has a solid pot, there's no hole in it, then it's not considered connected to the ground. Then maybe I'm okay. There's more to discuss. Are the branches extending out of the pot? They're in the airspace of the ground. I'm not going into the whole discussion about Shemitah now. The point, though, is that planting in a pot that's not connected to the ground may be considered okay during Shemitah. And the way the Egle Tal frames it is that the reason it's okay during Shemitah is because it's an unusual way to plant. Not because, well, it's not connected to the ground, therefore it's not called. He says it's not called planting as far as Shemitah is concerned. It's a shinui. It's unusual. So now my question is, where does shinui matter? Where doesn't shinui matter? And he comes up with the following formulation, which is ingenious and gets quoted by everybody after the Egle Tal. He says, and this is going to matter a lot as we try to figure out what constitutes a shinui. He says, one kind of shinui, let me just see which order he's going to present it in so I don't mess everything up. Yeah. One type of shinui is a shinui in result. Another type of shinui is a shinui in the method, how you get to that result. Where your result is inferior, that's a shinui for everything. If the result is not going to be good, it has to be inferior, not better. If it's inferior, that's, for all areas of halacha, that constitutes a shinui. Whereas, if it's just that your method of doing it is an inferior method, but the result's going to look the same, that's only a shinui as far as Shabbos is concerned. Clear?
No, I'm a little bit confused about that. What does it mean that result is like every, like for the, like I don't understand like what you mean by all.
For every area of halacha, if the result that you're going to produce is an inferior result, then it's no longer, you're no longer chayav biblically, for whatever that is, not Shabbos, whatever that particular halacha is. Whereas, if you just use an unusual method to obtain the result, but the result is still fundamentally the same, then it's a shinui as far as Shabbos is concerned. But it's not a shinui in any other area. The sofer wrote the get. It's a kosher get. It looks fine. The letters are right and all that. Just use his left hand. That's not considered a shinui. It's considered real writing. Sofer wrote a sifrei Torah with his left hand. But again, it was written just fine, then it's a kosher sefer Torah. I don't care that he used his left hand. It's only where the result is inferior, that's where we're going to say it's a shinui for other areas of halacha.
I feel like that still applies to the case that we're talking about, like, let's say, like a cheeseburger.
Yeah.
So that's saying that it could be a shinui if that result isn't as good for something like that, not just Shabbos.
So, potentially, yes. If you took a cheeseburger, I'm not sure he would put this under shinui. He might call it not achila for some other reason, but let's use the cheeseburger example. If you took dish soap and poured it on the cheeseburger, so that now the cheeseburger is terrible to taste, then yes, you could potentially not be liable for eating a cheeseburger and midi oraisa. Still don't do it, but yeah. Yes?
When it becomes, like, inedible, like, specifically the cheeseburger example, like, if once it's considered, like, not food anymore, that's, like, why you're, like, sort of allowed to do it.
Right, so it's not a great example because there are other...
If you're in the sun and it gets all rotten and then you eat
right.
it, it's not considered food and you're just, like, eating
right.
garbage, which is weird.
Yeah,
but
right. But it's also... that may not... I'm rethinking using that as an example because the question is it because it's not called food or is it because it's not called an act of eating? You know, maybe we would look at the inferior cheeseburger not so much as a shinui in eating, but because this isn't food anymore. So it could be other logic is involved. But take a look at what he says here in number 4. He says, Malacha kila achar yad, we're in the second paragraph in number 4. Malacha kila achar yad yesh b'shnei ofanim. You have two types of malacha performed, so to speak, with the back of one's hand. Yesha malacha atzma biltinif eles karaoi, vehi shinui be'echus hanif'al, where the malacha itself is not done properly. The malacha itself is not done in the right way, so that there is a change in the... Yeah, I'm wondering if my translation is really the best translation I could have given. I mean, it is. It's a literal translation, but I may not be so clear, so I'm going to try to explain it along the way. Where the malacha is not done properly, and there is a change in the quality of the result. That's really what I'm trying to say. That which is caused is a confusing phrase. The result is inferior. Ke'inyan hanizra ba'atzitz she'eno nakuv. Like the case of planting in a pot that doesn't have a hole in it. Shelo nizra ki orche. So it's not planted the way that you normally plant. Av she'be'echus ha'po'el lo ha'yashum shinui. But the action was the same as any other action. Meaning, when I plant something in a pot, there are certain steps that I do. It doesn't matter whether the pot has a hole in it or doesn't have a hole in it. I'm doing the same actions. A person looking at me putting something in that pot will not know offhand by watching what I do whether the pot has a hole or doesn't have a hole. Right? Unless they can see the bottom of the pot, they're not going to know. It's the same action. Clear? There's no distinction to be made. It's only the end result that's different, which is plants that grow in pots that don't have holes tend to do worse. Plants will do better when they can have proper drainage, right? Especially if the roots are also able to draw nutrition from the ground below. So it's the result that's inferior, but the method was the same. V'yesh malacha kila achar yad shushinui be'echus ha'po'el levad v'lo be'echus ha'nif'al. On the other hand, you have malacha which is done in an unusual way, with the back of the hand, so to speak, which is a shinui in the way you perform the action and not in the result. Kigon, for example, ha'motzi merishus l'rishus kila achar yado. You take an item from one area to another using the back of your hand. Right, you're carrying with your foot. So he says, after etzem hamalacha he b'hachefetz hamuvala rishus acheres. He says the malacha is done with the item that is brought to the other domain. U'b'hachefetz ein shum shinui. There is no difference in the item itself. U'munach ata b'rishus acheres ki'ilu hayamotzi kedarko, and it's sitting in the other domain as though you had taken it out normally, right? In other words, if this is one rishus and the hallway is another rishus, right? This is public domain and that's private domain. Whether I carried the item in my pocket or in my hand or in my teeth or in my hair doesn't make a difference. At the end of the day, the item moved from here to there. The result is the same. The method is what was different. So he says, in that case, Rakshi Yeshina Bechaz HaPoel, he said, well, doesn't really make a difference. The point is that because there was only a shinui in the quality of the act and not in the quality of the result, that's only a shinui for Shabbos purposes and not for anything else. Naomi.
Would it make a difference, or would it just be considered a result if it had both?
Yeah. What do you think? What if it has both? It's different in action and different in result. Then what? What would you say? Is it a shinui for everything, or is it a shinui just for Shabbos then?
For everything, but like, would it be considered a better shinui?
Maybe. You could argue that it's a better shinui. For sure it's for everything, because you have the minimum point, which is that your result isn't good. Is it better to do it that way? Maybe. You can make that argument. Yeah. I hear. So so when I'm looking to define a shinui for Shabbos purposes, it's sufficient that the action be performed in an abnormal way, even if the result is going to be the same. But we're not quite there yet, because there's one more stage that we're going to need. Ella and then Tova.
Is, like, it being really messy with the left hand not considered a different result?
It may be, yeah.
Okay.
It may be.
But the get, it was saying, like...
But the get was written right. You have to keep in mind also, when you're dealing with a get, the goal of it is not that the letters look nice. The goal is simply that it's kosher.
Yeah.
So as long as he can do that with his left hand, it doesn't matter if it looks messy. Yeah. That's all it's needed. Tova.
So like, if you were like ripping toilet paper on the lines with your elbow, that would be like a shinui for Shabbos, like a different thing but the same result. But then if you like ripped it normally but like not on the lines, then that would be like the other. Like,
so
result.
Right. So that's where I'm going next. So it's a good question. See source number 5 and then see if that answers your question.
Okay.
Okay. Because we do need one more step. What constitutes an unusual way to do something? A week or two ago, I talked about the person who needed the elevator on Shabbos, right? Very sick, needs to get to their room, right? And wants to use the back of their knuckle as a shinoi to push the elevator button. Now, at the end of the day, the elevator is coming the same way, right? There is no difference in the quality of summoning the elevator, right? The button was pressed, the circuit was completed, the alert was sent to the elevator to get to this floor. If you ask the elevator, so to speak, there was nothing unusual that happened at all, right? There was no shinoi. It's just a shinoi in method. So what qualifies as a shinoi in method? What if she pushes the elevator button with her left hand? Is that a shinoi?
No.
No, why not?
As a normal person
would do it. Would normal people do that? I don't know. Yeah, you're saying normal people would push the elevator button with their left hand. We should do a study downstairs, set up a camera on the elevator buttons. I think the first time they push it with their right hand. But by the time they get to like the fifth or sixth, where they're just doing it, you know, because they're annoyed, then they start using their left hand. I don't know. The
I don't think it takes extra strain.
Yeah.
To like use your left hand if you usually use right.
So strength isn't the word I would have used.
Not sure.
Dexterity.
Yeah.
Right. It's really about dexterity. Is it any harder to push the elevator button with your left hand than your right hand? The answer tends to be no. Depends a little bit on your gross motor control and your fine motor control, but more or less, you know, people can manage to push an elevator button with their left hand. So maybe that's the difference. Maybe it's about how easy it is for you to do it. Take a look at what Rabbi Bornstein said in his Avnei Nezer, in source number 5. He says, Nirali Pashut, he says, it appears obvious to me, Dehamochek Bismolo Chayav, if you erase with your left, right? Instead of erasing with your right, you erase with your left, you're still liable, bless you. Kimo hamotzi bismolo, just like if you carry something in your left hand. There is no inferiority. Well, I'm jumping the gun by using that word. He says, v'davka hakosev, it's only with writing. She'eno yachol lichtov b'tov bismol. You can't write well with your left hand. If you're a righty, then you're potter. Then you're exempt from liability. And if you can write well with it, if you're ambidextrous, like the question was asked before, then it's not a shinoi at all. The key point that he's making is that you have to be doing it in a way that is not just unusual. Whoops, this is a right mark. But it doesn't work. So we'll go back to this one. It has to be not only unusual, but inferior. It has to be an inferior way to do it. So that pushing the elevator button with your knuckle doesn't really sound like a shinoi anymore. Right? Because, you know, how inferior is that to go like this instead of going like this? It's harder then to come up with a shinoi. You see this idea in the Rambam in source number 6. The Rambam is talking about carrying things on Shabbos, and he says something that when you first read it, at least to me, it's counterintuitive. Take a look. He says, Hamotzi mas'ui al rosho. Let's pause before reading it, actually. He says, you carry an item on your head through an area where there's no eruv. Two different cases now. Okay, really, don't read ahead. If someone read ahead, you're not eligible for this. That doesn't mean it's a bad thing to read ahead. It's a good thing to read ahead. But the person carries an item on their head. Two different cases. Number one, you carry a heavy item on your head. Number two, you carry a light item on your head. Which one is more likely to be a shinoi? Will you carry a heavy item on your head or a light item on your head?
Light.
Heavy?
No, light.
Light?
Because it's like way more it's random hard to put something light on your head.
Okay, so those who are saying light, you're saying it because you don't normally do it?
Yeah, like you could just hold it in your hand.
No, I was thinking because it would fall more easily, but I guess like it depends how it's shaped and everything, you know?
Maybe. He doesn't give that. The Rambam won't tell us how it's shaped. So those who are saying that a heavy item is the shinoi, saying that why?
It's harder
to do because it's a heavy item.
Like, it's easier.
It's not so common that you're carrying something really heavy on your head.
Yeah,
No, I feel like if it's just like you're in an ultimate way, you use your head to
Keep in mind, this is the Rambam talking. Where does the Rambam live and when?
Oh, in Egypt.
Egypt in the 12th century.
Where they carry
it's a lot more common to carry things on your head because their cars weren't working.
But I'm
right?
sure it was still harder to carry heavy things on the head.
No, I think heavy is when you do put on your head.
Oh, so then light.
So
no,
we're going to see what the Rambam does.
Yeah,
you
like,
it's
heavy.
Maybe because it's usual, you shouldn't do it.
So keep in mind, we don't want it to be unusual. We want it to be inferior. Right? Take a look. Take a look at what the Rambam says. He says, Hamotzi masui al rosho, when you take out an item on your head, im haya masui kaved, if it's heavy, kigon sak male, a full bag, oteva, or a box, umigdal, a cabinet, something like that. Shuhumesim al rosho v'tofes biado. Because it's big and heavy, you hold it with your hand. You don't just put it on your head and walk down the street. You're bracing it with your hand. Chayav. Then you're liable. Shekein derech hamotzi in, because that's what people do. That's how they transport things. V'nimtza kamotzi akteifo biado. It's just like carrying it on your shoulder or in your hand. That's normal. Aval, im laka chefetz kal, but if you take a light item, kigon she'iniach beged, a piece of clothing, o sefer, a book, o sakin, or a knife, that's daring, al rosho, v'hotzio, and you can't transport it, v'hu eino ochez biado, and you're not holding it with your hand, you're just walking down the street expecting it to be balanced on your head. Hare ze pater shelo hotzi kederach hamotzi in. He says, then you're exempt biblically, because you didn't transport it in the normal way. She'ein derech rov ha'olam lahotzi achepzin munachin al roshehem. Because people don't normally take items like this on their head. So he's supporting the idea that we see in the Avnei Nezer, saying that it's about this being something unusual, and unusual in the sense that this is an inferior thing to do. That's the idea. Rina.
But nowadays, people are less likely to carry something on their head.
Yeah.
Maybe like in the show, people still do. But like, so does it change because it becomes unusual
yes.
and inferior again?
Correct. Shinui is going to be dependent on the context. It depends on what people normally do. Now, once you say what people normally do, you realize it's not about, well, it's not necessarily about the whole world, but it's not about you either. You know, you can't say, I always do it this way, and therefore to do it differently is a shinoi. That doesn't work. It's about the population overall. How you define the limits of the population is a really good question. Not so clear. Yeah?
Is it like the whole population or different parts of the world that can vary?
Right, so that's what I mean when I say unclear. I mean, it's for sure not the whole world. The question is how narrowly you draw it. Let's say, for example, you stay in the dorm. So the population in the dorm is girls of a particular age range for whom we generally associate, although it won't be true for 100% of them, but you know, whatever percentage is, have the same sort of physical abilities, right? They will be outliers, but the same basic physical abilities. That's not necessarily going to be applicable if you go into a nursing home. Right, where their physical abilities are different and therefore they may do things in different ways. So defining population for Shinui is not so straightforward. I'm trying to give just sort of basic principles. Okay, so based on what we've said, coming up with a valid Shinui is not so simple. Let's say writing. Writing, we can say, right? If you're a righty, writing with your left. If you're a lefty, writing with your right. That's a valid example of a shinui. What if you have to type something into a computer? If you work in a hospital, you are likely entering people's vitals using a computer system, not by writing it down in a chart. How do you type with a shinui?
Maybe just like one finger?
Maybe using one finger. That could be an example. Yeah?
It just like takes forever.
Right. It does take forever. I mean, maybe typing with a knuckle would be more clear cut as a shinui, but typing with a finger, as you just noted, takes forever. It's an inferior result. And it's not what one would do if one, you know, knew how to type.
My brother so, types like that.
Yeah? Well, you shouldn't say that, because that's Lashon Hara. Now the whole world knows. So...
It's not bad. He likes it. He thinks it's better.
Okay. I'll give you a practical case that comes up for people who are diabetic and they need to test their blood sugar. So a standard way to test blood sugar involves a machine in which you insert a test strip. And the machine is, you know, an electronic machine. So the person has the test strip. They need to test their blood for glucose content. What do? Can they do it with a Shinui? So take a look at source number 7. Rabbi Dr. Avram Sofer Abraham in the Nishmas Avram, which I've mentioned to you before. And he quotes his Rebbe, Rav Neuwirth, who wrote the Shmir Shabbos Kehilchasa. So he says, Amar li mori Rebbe agon Rav Yeshua Neuwirth shlita, shemuter lo laso says kol ha-pu'ulos ha'ele b'Shabbos. He says, Rav Neuwirth said, you're allowed to do all of these things. When he says all of these things, he means the blood testing for the diabetic. You can do them on Shabbos. Mikaven sheyesh lo hagdara shel chola sheyesh bo sakana, because the patient is considered to be dangerously ill. Vafilu kama pa'amim, you can do it as much as you need to do on Shabbos. We'll have to talk about diabetics if we get there later in the semester. And when they're a yesh bo sakana, when they're an imbo sakana. But he says, dahainu, specifically, what is it you're allowed to do? Hotsoas dam me etzba'o, taking blood from the finger in order to be able to test it. V'gam b'dikaso b'machshir, as well as testing it in the machine. Ach yishtadel, but he says you should try im efsher, where possible, lahadlikas hamachshir al yedei sha'on shabbat al yedei nochri, to turn on the device with a Shabbos clock, or by having a non-Jew be the one to turn it on. Oh, im einze efshari, or if that's not possible, bishinui, in an unusual way, parentheses, dahainu im gav ha'etzba, using the back of the finger, using a knuckle. Orbach went along with that as well. I actually thought I had a different note here, but I realize it's not on that. It's going to be on the Grumma section. There's going to be a separate separate issue, but we're not there yet. We're on Shinoi right now. So yeah, this is just the point about turning on the device using the back of one's finger. But again, that can apply to a tabletop, you know, glucose tester. That's not necessarily going to apply when it's pushing the button on the elevator. It's all about, you know, is this an inferior action or not? Going like this is a lot easier than going like this. That could really be the distinction. Yeah. Right. So it may not be so easy, but it could if, let's say, it's going to go on for a period of a few hours. You know, they know that before they're going to eat lunch, they need to know their blood sugar. Right, drawing the blood is not going to work with a Shabbos clock.
Yeah.
That is correct. There are some things you can do with a Shinui and some things you just can't. Yeah.
What was
that's not a Shinui. Shabbos clock isn't a Shinui. It's a different point. Yeah.
What was the did he say
you're allowed to push? So, I think, if a person is stuck and they're a chola shembo sakana and this is all they have, then they're gonna push the elevator button in whatever means and hope that qualifies as a Shinui. But if you asked me, does pushing an elevator button with your knuckle count lechatchila, you know, I would say not. Maybe elbow is better. I could see the argument that elbow is better. You know, I mean, I would have suggested using your foot, but probably if you can do that, you're not, you know, in need of the elevator. You have to work with what you have available. Yes.
So what he's saying here is not really like talking about like the situation of the person, whether he's like, it's more just saying that we're highlighting the fact that it's an inferior way to use the back of the finger.
Yes.
Okay.
That's so correct. Yeah. Yes.
Would you also like draw blood, like if people normally do it like from their finger, would you do it from like your foot? Would that like
That's interesting. Drawing blood from a foot instead of a finger, would that count as a Shinui? So I don't think so. Right, it's not an unusual way to draw blood from your foot. So it is getting blood in a different way, but I don't think that makes it a Shinoi, because fundamentally the problem is the drawing of blood from your foot has to be with a Shinoi. It's inferior in the sense that it's an inferior way to test blood, but it's not an inferior way to draw blood. if you had to draw blood from someone's foot, you know, for some reason, that's the way you would do it, drawing blood from their foot. It's not at the end of the day, a shinui in your result or a shinui in your method. Yeah, but the malacha isn't testing blood. The malacha is drawing blood, and that's exactly what you're doing. You know, it doesn't matter. It's your method of drawing blood from your foot is still, this is how you draw blood from a foot. It's not, it's what you need is a method where there's a shinui within that thing itself. So in other words, if you said, and this is entirely hypothetical and not a medical recommendation, but let's say you said that the quality of your result will be different. Like, you know, like we said, planting in a pot that doesn't have a hole in it, right? If the quality of the blood that you get will be different because it was from the foot, and that's why we don't normally take from the foot. Let's pretend that that's true. I don't know. You know, then you have a shinui, but then you have a problem because you really need to get the right blood because this person is sick.
What if, like, your right arm is known to have, like, better veins, so you mm-hmm.
That's an interesting question. I'm not sure.
Yeah, but then
it's, that's a legitimate question.
Which is like also something that you're not allowed to do.
Right, but it may be on the hierarchy of considerations. It may be less of a consideration. That's the question. Okay. So this was all our second of three methods of mitigation. Right? We had Amir La'akum. We had Shinui. Our third is Grama. Just to tell you, by the way, the quiz clearly we're not going to get to today. I think it'll probably end up being like the beginning of next class. It will be on this, and it's going to be a relatively straightforward quiz. I'm going to give you questions on each of the three, and you're going to need to answer one question from each of them, just so you know what's coming. So in other words, there will be a question. You will need to answer a question about Amir La'akum. You will need to answer a question about Grama, about Shinui, and you will need to answer a question about Grama. That's really what it comes down to. But you will have multiple options from each. Sorry? This is just the quiz. This is not the midterm. No, the midterm is much scarier. Okay.
You didn't do Grama yet, right?
No, Grama is what we're starting now.
Okay.
That is correct. Also, there is not yet any clarity, just from the question I asked last time about next semester, there is not yet any clarity about what I am going to be teaching because I gave them my answer on Friday and now they're thinking about it. So we'll see. It depends on what the needs are within the program for more advanced classes or more intermediate classes. That's what's going to determine whether I'll do an advanced part two or an intermediate part one. And we'll see. So I don't know yet. Okay. Grama. Anybody know what the word grama means? We mentioned it last time. Sorry? Right. You cause a result. You didn't do the result. You didn't create the result, but your action indirectly led to it. To be goreim something is to cause it. When we talk about a mitzvah, as mitzvahs aseh shehazman grama, what we mean is a commandment which it becomes obligatory because of the time. The time creates the obligation. You follow? That's the idea of mitzvahs aseh shehazman grama. The time caused the obligation. So making Kiddush on Shabbos. The time, it being Shabbos, created the obligation. Goreim, Grama. Grama is just Aramaic. That's all it is. Grama comes up in a lot of different areas of halacha. It's not just a Shabbos thing. So the best example of that is the laws of Nezikin, of damaging somebody else's property. That we'll do a little bit on the Chaveru. Let's give the following circumstance. Let's take a fun example. Oh, I'll use the classic. You are standing on the roof of a building, or you're standing on the 10th floor in the dorm and you're at the window, whatever you like. You're holding somebody else's clock. You drop the clock out the window, it smashes on the ground. Bad idea. Please do not try this at home. Or in the dorm. So you are chayev or pater? This is not a trick question.
Chayev.
You're liable, right? You broke the person's clock. You stand at that window. You're holding the clock. You look down and you see a trampoline. Or you see a big, massive pillow. Clock's going to be fine. Let's pretend that that's true, okay? You know the clock is going to be fine. You drop the clock out the window, it lands on the pillow, and it doesn't break. Everything is good, right? Nothing's wrong. I mean, your friend might be annoyed, but at the end of the day, it's all good. You drop the clock out the window, somebody moves the pillow before the clock hits the ground. Are you chayiv?
Yeah.
Why? When you dropped it, nothing was going to happen. Okay, it's not nice to drop clocks out the window. Fine,
no,
but
yeah.
Use your own. Not only was there no intention, when you dropped it, the moment of your action, nothing was going to happen.
So grumma means intention?
No, grumma does not mean intention. Sorry, I didn't hear.
You caused the damages.
You caused it, but you caused it indirectly. That's the key. So neither one is chayev. You are not chayev as the person who dropped the clock out the window, because when you dropped the clock, nothing was going to happen. The person who moved the pillow is not chayev either, because they're not the one who dropped the clock. They just moved the pillow. Even if they saw the clock falling, they're still not chayev. Now, let me hasten to add, you're chayev b'dinei shamayim. What that means is, Beis Din can't punish you, Beis Din can't make you pay for it, but Hashem will hold you responsible to make this person whole. You still have to make it up to...
Is that all grumma?
So that is the basic principle for grumma.
So how would you translate grumma?
So grumma is still indirect. It's indirect causation. What you did, in and of itself, did not cause the clock to break. Something else had to happen in order to cause the clock to break. Now, there is another category, an in-between category, called garmi. And I do not want to get into why it has a different name than grumma, from grumma. But garmi is where your action is indirect, but it's still pretty direct. I mean, there are a lot of different ways to do garmi, and I don't want to turn this into a shiur about garmi, but I'll give you the classic example of garmi. You are a money changer. The job of a money changer is not only that people give you dollars and you give them back shkalim. The job of a money changer in the days of the Gemara is also to verify that coins are valid. You were going to be in a transaction with somebody. They have to give you a certain amount of gold. You want to know, is this actually legit? You go to the money changer. They want to give you a coin. You don't know if this is a legitimate coin that people accept or not. They're from some other land or whatever it is. You go to the money changer. The money changer tells you, yeah, this is valid or this is not valid. You, as a money changer, have somebody come to you and say, is this coin legit? You barely look at it. You don't bother to look at it. Or you didn't get proper training and you give them the wrong answer. They accept you tell them it's valid. They accept the coin. Then they try to spend it and they find out it's not valid. So there, you're... Technically, what you did was an indirect thing, right? You told them it's a valid coin. They accepted the coin. You didn't physically harm them in any way. You didn't take any money from them. So you could argue grumma, but we don't. We say that's called garmi because the guy accepted the coin on your say-so. So I've gotten too far afield. That was probably a mistake to go that far afield. Let's go back to Shabbos. If you take a look at source number 8, this is the classic source for the issue of grumma when it comes to the laws of Shabbos. It is a Mishnah. It's talking about how you deal with a fire on Shabbos. You don't have a fire department at your disposal. So what do you do? Because extinguishing a fire on Shabbos is not allowed. So what do I do? So if there's a threat to life, the answer is do whatever you need to do. This isn't the conversation. But there's no threat to life. Your property is far apart from somebody else's property. The fire is going to burn out before it ever gets to be, that kind of a hazard. But right now, the fire is spreading, and it's consuming your stuff. And you're not able to move your stuff out of the way. I'm just creating a hypothetical. So now, what do you do? So look at this Mishnah. Va'osin mechitza b'chol hakelim. You're allowed to bring vessels to make a barrier. Bein maleim, bein reikonin. Whether they are full, whether they are empty, doesn't make a difference. Bishvil shalotav or hadlekas, that the fire is not going to cross. You make a barrier, it keeps the fire from crossing. Now, here's the key line. Rabbi Yossi oser b'klecheres chadashim malein mayim. Rabbi Yossi says, I don't want you to use new pottery jugs that are holding water. The idea of a new jug as opposed to an old one is that it's more likely to crack due to the heat of the fire. It's holding water. What's the method he doesn't want you to use? And the water will put out the fire. He doesn't want you to extinguish the fire by putting water in the way, and the fire is going to get there, and the fire is going to crack it, and the water will come out and do that. He says, "Lefi she'en yachol lekabel ha'ur," because these new jugs cannot tolerate the fire. "Vein misbakin u'mechaben es hadleika," they'll split and they'll extinguish the fire. So Rabbi Yossi says, "I don't want you doing that," but the Tanakhama is fine with you doing that. The first view in the Mishnah is okay with you doing that. That is a case of grama. Right? Everyone clear that it's grama? It's indirect. You didn't pour water on the fire. That will be direct. You put water there, and the fire came to the water. That's why it's grama. Got it? Yeah.
So we follow the Tanakhama, not...
Correct. We follow the Tanakhama. And the Ritva explains why. One second, Chayla. If you take a look at source number 9, the Ritva, Rabbi Yom Tov Elasvili, explains why. He says, in the middle of that line, he says, Nehi deleka isura de'oraisa. He's dealing with a separate part of the Gemara that I'm not going into, but he says, there is no biblical violation. Ki bevadai ein grama bichlal asiya. Because grama is not action. This is not you doing the malacha. You caused the malacha, but you didn't actively do it. That's why it's not a de'oraisa. That's the idea. Chayla, you were going to ask.
So if somebody's house is like a shama on fire, you can't call
911? So, no. 100%, where there's any risk to life, and in
the,
so in the current environment, with the way we build houses, it's going to spread to somebody else's house. Yeah, it's not as though it'll just, you know, burn itself out. Where you knew 100% that it's just going to be a property thing, and there's nothing beyond that, so then the orisas wouldn't be okay. The rabbanans would be okay, but the orisas would not be okay. How you do it with the rabbanan is a great question. There's a lot of discussion in the Gemara about what exactly one is allowed to do to save property from a fire. It's much more complex than what I'm giving it right now. Yeah, Ricky.
So theoretically, if there was like a forest fire, and it was like all the way in the forest,
yeah.
And if there was like a Jewish person who was like a firefighter or something, he wouldn't be able to put out the fire because it's like all the way in the forest.
So forest fires, I think we've learned, do spread.
Right, but what's it really?
Let's say it wouldn't, it's just going to, yeah, then you would have to leave it alone. I mean, you can do the rabbanans, you just can't do the orisas.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, Ella.
If grandma was, like, in the case where it's not, like, on Gosh Shabbos, then could it be the orisa because there are rules that aren't necessarily, like lotases, aren't actions. So then grandma...
Right, so that raises all sorts of very interesting questions. Let's say you benefit from meat and milk. Right? Via grama.
Right.
Right? Something like that. This is a good question. Way beyond the scope of what I'm prepared to talk about today. But it's a good question. So, what we're saying here is that grama gets you out of a de'oraisa, but here are two key... just one key note. It won't apply where the malacha is normally done via grama. Where the malacha normally happens via grama, that doesn't apply. Then it's not called grama. I'm going to give you two examples. I'll give you one example, and then I'll show you a second one, which once you say it, you're like, oh, of course, that makes perfect sense. But first I'll give you one that's not as obvious. Anyone know what Zore is? Zion Vav Resh Hay? It is one of the Lametes Malachas, that is true. Winnowing, correct. What is winnowing? Right, good. Right. When you have grain,
so it's like
after you've crushed the grain and now you have the chaff, which is lighter, mixed in with the grain that you actually want, which is heavier. So the method of winnowing is you toss it up when the wind is blowing, and the lighter stuff will blow away, and the heavier stuff will fall to the ground, and that way you've now got the stuff that you want from the grain. That's called zora, that's called winnowing. So... The Aruch HaShulchan, Rabbi Yechiel Michal Epstein, points out that that's technically grumma. Right? All you do is toss it up in the air, and the wind is what's going to blow away the chaff. But because that's the way winnowing is done, you can't say, well, grumma. You follow? Can anybody think of another malacha? It's one of the most basic malachas of Shabbos that is normally done via grumma. It's one of the most basic malachas of Shabbos. We spend a lot of time on Friday avoiding this happening on Shabbos. Sorry? Someone just said? Cooking. Right? When you put something in an oven, it will eventually cook because of the heat in the oven. You are not heating up the food. All you're doing is putting it in the oven. The oven is what's going to do the cooking. But that's the way you cook. Like, that's all there is. There is no non-grumma way to cook things. So that's also going to be a deraisa. We don't say, well, that's only a derabanan now. Clear? There are other examples that you could bring, but I just wanted to highlight that. Okay, so can we define grumma? Rav Chaim Odzer was a leading posek, if not the leading posek, in Eastern Europe in the first half of the 20th century. A major, major name in Psak. He gets quoted a lot in the gelatin discussion of whether gelatin made from an animal is kosher or not, because he ruled that it was kosher. And that's why there are many, many fully observant Jews who will eat gelatin from an animal, because Rav Chaim Odzer said that basically, to make a long story short, the way that you process the animal hide and the bones removes it entirely from the category of food in any way, shape, or form, and therefore now it's just powder and now it can be turned into gelatin. There's more to it, of course, but that's the basics of the issues. He gets quoted in that debate, but Rav Chaim Odzer was a major, major halachic authority. And in source number 10, he's dealing with the electricity issue in the 1930s regarding turning on a light bulb. Can you argue that turning on a light bulb is grumma? You complete the circuit and the electricity flows through the circuit, and then, he's dealing with an incandescent, heats up the filament so that it glows. So take a look at source number 10. He says, Vihine, Be'ikar hadavar shemva'arim b'hayarchon, ofen hadlakas ha'electric. He says, as the way to generate electricity or turn on electricity is explained in the journal, he read up on the physics of it as it was understood in his day, Shebeterem hikanso l'toch hazechuchis hefsek yesh bo. Before the wire enters the glass, meaning the light bulb, before the wire gets in, there's a gap, right? You know how a circuit works, right? You all did, grade school physics. So there's a gap in the circuit. Uchshemesaveves hagalgal, and when you turn the wheel, that was the light switch, system that they had, turn the wheel, naset tzipui katzar zeh me'in gesher shazerem over alav. You get this little bridge that will complete the circuit, and now the electricity can flow. Ulefiza yesh lidon. So he says, now we have to analyze. When you turn this button that's in the assembly, eino ella grumma bialma. So that's just grumma. It's indirect. The way that Rav Chaim Odzer is imagining electricity is the electricity needs to cross the bridge. You put the bridge there. Now the electricity can cross. But that's grumma. You didn't push the electricity across the bridge. It was just that you just closed it. You closed the bridge, and that was all you did. You follow? He says it's just like a case in which, this is the example that the Gemara gives from which I drew the thing you threw out the window. You shoot an arrow in that direction. Somebody is holding a shield there. They drop the shield after you shoot the arrow, and now the arrow can hit somebody. So what you did in shooting the arrow was indirect. So that's the question. And he goes on to say, I asked an engineer, And he ends up saying, and this is the key point, the last line in number 10. I know, when you have a quiz, I feel like, to a certain extent, it makes it easier for everybody in the class because it breaks up the class a little bit. Following all this for an hour and a quarter, it can be hard. But let's just get through Rav Chaim Moser, and then we'll come back to it on Wednesday. He says, the end of Rav Chaim Moser, he says, Harei mevur midivrei harama. He quotes Rav Moshe HaKohen, dealing with a different issue altogether. He says, if when they shoot the arrow at the shield, the arrow is right next to the shield when you're shooting it. So, in that case, when they remove the shield, it's really like you shot the arrow straight into whoever it is who gets hit with it, because it's immediate. That's the key. That's what matters to Chaim Moser. The same thing is true here. When you do this, when you make the circuit complete, the electricity crosses right away. So therefore, he argues, leave aside the question of electricity and did it exist before the circuit was completed, or did your completion of the circuit actually create the electricity. He's not looking at it from that perspective. But his point is, and the point that's relevant for us is, in the event that the result happens immediately after your action, then it's not called grama. There has to be a time delay between them. Now, he has not defined for me what a time delay is, right? When you drop the thing out the window and it's accelerating, right, 9.8 meters per second or whatever that is, that feels pretty immediate. Like, exactly where is the line on what constitutes immediate, he has not defined for us. But it won't matter so much, because we are going to move to a little bit of a different definition as we go along. So there's going to be more to say about this. But right now, what you need to know out of grama is that doing something indirectly can reduce it to a derabanan instead of being a deraisa. Clear? Thank you.